many detective shows, your Sunday night on WHFR Sunday Night Mystery Extravaganza. 9 p.m. until midnight on 89.3 WHFR.
The station making the waves.
Coming next, a special WHFR Thanksgiving presentation from our friends at PRX Public Radio Exchange. You are listening to WHFR Dearborn from the campus of Henry Ford College. Happy Thanksgiving from your friends at WHFR and today's WHFR Journal program. Happy Thanksgiving from your friends at WHFR and today's WHFR Journal program. We bring you a special program from our friends at PRX Public Radio Exchange. All about Thanksgiving and giving thanks. Enjoy.
Grazie.
Danke sehr.
Merci.
Gracias.
Hola.
Obrigado.
Molto chiacchiera.
Thank you well.
Grazie, merci, thank you, grazie, grazie.
Muchas gracias, thank you, thank you.
Merci beaucoup. The 14th century mystic Meister Eckhart once said, if the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, it will be enough. The medieval philosopher wasn't alone. Down through the years, theologians have suggested the ability to be thankful is the mother lode of all the virtues. Once you've nailed gratitude, you're in pretty good shape, spiritually speaking. But this business of giving thanks can be a tricky thing, and maybe people aren't always as pure as Meister Eckhart believed. There's fake gratitude and conditional gratitude, and there's the debt of gratitude, expecting thanks and praise when you've done someone a good turn. Have you ever noticed that human beings can take the most straight-ahead virtue and turn it into a vice? This is Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines. Two words. Thank you. They sound simple enough. Ah, but in the hands of Margaret Visser, nothing is simple for long. There's always more to a topic or to a phrase or to a ritual than you might have thought. Margaret Visser has turned her scholarly eye towards gratitude. The result is a book called The Gift of Thanks, The Roots, Persistence, and Paradoxical Meanings of a Social Ritual. Margaret Visser, welcome to Tapestry.
Thank you for having me.
What is it about two words? Thank you, that sparked your interest. Yes.
Well, in French, it's only one word.
Absolutely, merci.
Merci. Well, it's that I discovered that in our culture, in Anglo-Saxon culture and in French culture, an ordinary human being just sort of living their life, everyday life, not working particularly among people the way you do, but just walking around, says thank you at least 100 times a day.
No, that's not possible. 100 times a day?
And if you will probably say it 200 or 300 times a day. So it seemed to me, you know, that as you know, I've always been interested in the ordinary.
Yes.
I've often taken things such as chairs or high heel shoes or something like that to examine. But it's all, there's also behavior. And it seemed to me that here was a piece of behavior that was so omnipresent, and yet people don't talk about it very much. They don't think about it. I might say that the psychologists have started just very, very recently getting interested in it. But until then, for a very, very long time, I mean, people talked about gifts nonstop. I'm talking about the scientists now, the social scientists, the economists, the psychologists, all these people who have high-paying jobs all love talking about gifts. And when I started to think, what is gratitude, I began to read and soon found that there's very little written about gratitude at all. And that's how I turned to gifts. And I read, there is just so much about gift-giving. It's a phenomenon in itself. It deserves to be examined. You
know, the writing of it.
Just the fact of how much there is. And I was stunned to discover that they were all very, very puzzled. They don't understand what's going on. It's considered a great enigma. The enigma mainly being, although it's not the only part of the enigma, but the main enigma is, why do we give back? Why, having received something from someone, do we feel we should give something back? And the assumption always is that we somehow we're forced into this. And the problem is, and the enigma is, how does society do it? How does it force us to give something back? And they totally ignore the fact that in our culture, I mean, the word gift implies that it's been given for nothing. I mean, if you get something and you pay for it, that's not a gift, you know. You have to pay for it.
In spite of all the advertisements that trumpet free gift. Oh, thank you, as opposed to a gift you'd like me to pay for.
Well, notice how they have to say free in front of it. Notice, because the assumption is that it might not be free. Okay, so there's a huge thing going on about freedom.
When you tell me though that a person is likely to say thank you, thanks, 100 times a day at least, what I wonder then is, it's so automatic as to be meaningless. If I'm parroting something 100 times a day, or I mean, in somebody else's case, maybe 200, 300, what's left? Is there anything of meaning left in that in that little phrase?
Well, there's a little experiment you might make to find out if it's meaningful or not. Try not saying it. You will find your life becomes very difficult very quickly.
Yes.
If somebody doesn't say thank you, it doesn't take very long between the frost comes down, you know. It is fascinating because, you know, it goes very deep, this. I mean, you give a present to somebody or do something for someone, and you don't do it because you want them to be grateful to you, although some social scientists will say you do. But you may feel, I've given this to somebody. I don't want thanks. I don't want to get something back. And then if they don't say thank you, you are outraged.
Outraged is the word.
You're furious.
It's no small thing.
It's no small thing. And it better be surprised. And then, of course, when they do say thank you, you then say, just nothing. It's not important at all. No, I've got plenty of that. My pleasure. And so on and so forth. So in other words, there's something here to be examined.
You're quite convinced, it seems to me, that this act of giving thanks is very tied up with the spiritual health of the human being.
Right.
And I wondered, are you talking specifically there about thanks to God, thanks to the divine, or just thanks to buddy next door who brings you a coffee? Are the two wound together somehow?
Yes. The history of the idea of gratitude, now gratitude has a history, relies at one point, one particular point, it gets a huge impact impetus in our culture from Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to the higher reaches of gratitude, you will find that people who have really gone the distance, I mean, the saints, the heroes, are able to be grateful. And here God comes in. Grateful to God for whatever happens, no matter what, they're grateful. I mean, it's almost incredible to a person like me, you know, an ordinary person, watching these people who are able to be in a concentration camp and thank God for their existence. Mm. I mean, just incredible feats. I mean, at the highest level, gratitude is one of the great sort of heroic virtues. But I that is amazing, but it's not obscure. It's clear what's going on there.
What is going on there?
What happens? You see, one of the ways human beings learn, and what makes us different. You see, we are different from animals in the sense that our instincts are deadened compared with animals. We don't have their instinctive response. That has been reduced in us. No, it hasn't gone, but it's been reduced in us. And what has taken its place is imitation. We imitate each other. We learn by imitating. Now, this can become, and it often is, a source of incredible violence. And you know, two people, you see something and you see somebody wanting something, and then you want it because they want it. Because we are imitative beings. We learn by imitating, and we say, oh, that's the thing you're supposed to want. But of course, they already want it. So before you know where you are, you're fighting over this thing. Imitation is built into our natures, because to take the place of the instincts we have lost, and it leads us into war very easily. So what do you do to get over this? We have this thing, you can't get rid of it. But what you can do, and this is the sort of thing that religion does extremely well, it takes this thing that we have and turns it into a good thing. The way it happens in religion is it, instead of imitating another person in their desire for the thing, when you return something to somebody, you're imitating the giver. You are also giving. But the religious dimension adds, we are imitating the first giver, God, when we give. Therefore, we don't have to ask for anything back. We've always already received. We are always the one who is giving back. We're always giving back. God has always given first. So it enables people to give and not want to receive something back.
What of this idea, though, of the giving thanks for all of it, for the wretched, for the worst thing that can befall a person, that you mentioned the saints, the martyrs. My life is in ruins. Thank you. Thank you for all of it.
Yes, I know. Tout est grâce, you know.
Yes,
this is what Saint Teresa said. Everything is grace. But it is true, you see, when you reach my age and my advanced age, you look back on your life and you realize that actually many of the most horrible things that have happened to you, in fact, were what you needed most, in order to grow, in order to see, in order to understand, in order to sympathize with other people, all those things. If you can manage to live through it, and if you're not destroyed by it, that can raise you up. So there are ways of seeing it like that. Well, I think perhaps I've written this book because I'm so old.
Margaret.
And it's true. I mean, I got to the point where I look back on my life. And one of the things that gratitude is, of course, is memory. Okay. So that's what gratitude is all about.
It's memory in what way?
Well, when somebody gives something to you, the rule is, and this is very interesting, the rule is you don't give something back immediately. You wait and give back later.
Okay. Unless
it's a sort of those festivals like Christmas where everybody gives it at the same time.
Yes.
That's very unusual. Normally, you receive something and then you wait and then you give something back. And the reason for that, well, there's a history to that. Some anthropologists have said, and I think that there's a lot of truth in this, that originally you had two tribes at war. and they fight all the time, you know. And then one day, one of the tribes says, look, you know, we've got a certain amount of, I don't know, what is it, coconuts or whatever it is that you haven't got, and we are giving them to you. Will you give something that you've got and we haven't got back? This is the birth of commerce. This is why it's so interesting today. But anyway, there is gift giving grows up and it takes the place of war. And that's commerce. You know, the exchange
yes.
prevents people fighting. And it's still an exchange, but it's not an exchange of blows. It's an exchange of benefits.
Stuff.
Benefits. And remember that if you do that, if somebody gives to you and then this tribe sort of holds onto the coconuts and thinks, now, gosh, you know, we're not fighting. What are we going to give back? And then they think for a while. And all the time that they're thinking, they're not fighting. So one of the things that not giving back immediately means is that the friendship continues during that time before the giving back takes place. Okay, and of course, if the giving back does not take place, well, then you'll be at war again, because there's nothing so enraging as expecting something back and not getting it. So it has grown up to be a rule that if when somebody gives you, you wait, and what you're supposed to do while you're waiting is appreciate, remember, think of the person, look at the gift that's standing on your mantelpiece or wherever it is, and think about it. And then, and also think about the person who gave it to you and think what they might like in return. Gratitude is not an automatic knee-jerk response. And this is one of the reasons why the scientists have not been interested in it, because they're interested in the biological. Okay, so they like disgust, they like rage, they like, I don't know, what are the other ones? Rage, disgust.
Ooh, envy. You know,
envy. Even envy's got thought in it. And they like things where you don't have any thought.
Right,
you know,
right,
at all.
Right.
You just sort of knee-jerk.
Yes.
And then that shows that it's the survival of the fittest and that we are just, you know, we are all just our genes and we can't help it and there's no freedom and it's just, you know, you're startled, right? Now that exists. I mean, I'm not denying that at all. I'm just saying that that's not all. And it has led them to ignore gratitude, because gratitude is feeling. It certainly is feeling. And that's a very interesting thing in itself. It's feeling and it's thinking both at the same time. The very word thanks comes from the German word denken, meaning to think.
Mm.
Okay, so thanks is I'm thinking. I'm thinking about somebody who's not me. I'm thinking of what they have done and why. I'm thinking of what I must now do. It's memory, and then it turns memory into the future. So gratitude is a narrative process. It turns the gift, it's sort of like a pivot from giving to giving again, so that it's a narrative and a memory, and it turns the past into the future.
You've mentioned that, and you deal with this at length in the book, that if it's true gratitude, it can't be compelled. It can't be wrung out of someone.
Yeah, you can't force somebody to be grateful.
You can't force it, unless you're a parent and the person is a child, in which case you certainly can say, did you say thanks to grandma? What do you say? What do you say to your auntie?
But remember that in our culture, you know, all cultures are built up on a series of oppositions, which are contradictory.
Mm.
But our culture makes a contradiction between morality and etiquette. Now, you can have all the etiquette you like. You can say thank you 100 times a day and never feel feel grateful at all. You can just do it automatically, which is better than not doing it at all. But it's not gratitude. So what a parent can do and does do, and we put a huge amount of effort into this, is fascinating. Just the amount of trouble people go to teach their children to do this thing, which is to say thank you. This is one of the proofs, by the way, that it's not something that just comes naturally.
Uh-huh.
Huh? It doesn't come naturally. It's taught. But what is, it's interesting, the parents teach a child to say, what do you say?
Yes.
What is the word?
The magic word is please.
The magic word
is
please.
Oh, no, that's right.
You press the button and you get what you want. That's easy. Yeah, because if a child knows if they say please, they'll get it. And if they don't, they won't get it, you know. But thank you. You've got it's very difficult. Children are taught to say bye-bye. You know, that's easy because the person waves and then they see the waving. They know, oh, that's bye-bye. So they say bye-bye and everybody's thrilled and happy and everybody exclaims and the child is rewarded. But thanking is very different because you get something and nobody does anything to make you say thank you unless the parents chip in with, what do you say? You know? But the day that the child without anybody telling them, remembers that they must say thank you is a tremendous step in a child's development. That means that they have recognized the scenario without having any signs from anybody else. They thought, this is a teddy bear this time. It's not a bowl of porridge or whatever. But I recognize that I've been given something that I must now, and they say thank you, and that's extraordinary. But later still, that child one day will actually feel gratitude. And that's another story altogether. And that nobody can make them feel. They come to that themselves. And it's infinitely more advanced than the etiquette. You know, we usually think that etiquette is sort of very complicated and you have to learn it and all that. But in this case, the etiquette is simple compared with that feeling. That feeling is really complex.
This is Tapestry on CBC Radio 1. If you're listening on satellite radio, you are on Sirius 137. I'm Mary Hines. My guest is the author Margaret Visser. We're talking about gratitude. Some of our earlier guests on the program, Coleman Barks, Michael Dowd, Paul Hawker, have talked about their profound sense of feeling grateful to something.
I felt very grateful. That's what it makes me want to bow sometimes. You know, I just feel, you know, thank you for whatever is happening. You know, I don't know what goes on.
First, we look at what living beings are actually giving their life for. So I'll say, you know, thank you chicken and thank you corn and thank you, you know, green beans or whatever. You know, to actually thank these living beings for the giving their life. So I'll say thank you for giving your life for us and so that we might become, that you might become us, that we're going to take in your atoms and molecules. And then I thank God, and what I mean by that is ultimate reality, the whole of reality that made every moment possible.
I didn't believe it at first. You know, like, I'm just seeing these drop-dead gorgeous sunsets. Like, it's just total visual smorgasbord. And I'm just spinning around and just soaking it all up. And I'm trying to express thank you, you know, like, to whatever, you know, to thank you, thank you, thank you. And this thought I'm getting back or the sense I'm getting back is thank you for turning up.
So compare the two feelings for me, the feeling of the by rote
Thanks very much, Margaret. Something that I might say 100 times a day without giving it a second thought. Compared to the more heartfelt, true kind of gratitude you're speaking about.
Well, that involves an emotion, and it's interesting to see what the gesture is that goes with it. I mean, there are various gestures. A lot of them are deference gestures, but the one that we feel most is you look into somebody's eyes when you say thank you. When you're realizing what you're doing is that you are recognizing that person. Notice the word recognizing. You are thinking about that person. You have that person really in your heart when you say thank you, when you're really grateful for something. And it lasts. It's another thing. That's another thing that disqualifies it, by the way, for scientists who believe that an emotion must last no more than 3 seconds.
This lasts.
This lasts. It doesn't fit the definition they've made. It doesn't mean to say that you, by lasting, I don't mean that you feel grateful incessantly. You can say, I've been grateful to him for 30 years. I remember what he did for me 30 years ago. It doesn't mean you do it all the time, but it's there. It's in your story. It's part of it's a narrative thing. You remember this thing and you never forget. Like Magwitch never forgot, you know, when Pip saved him, you know, among the tombs in the story of Great Expectations. He remembers it and he spends 16 years supporting Pip. And then Pip realizes what's happened and he's horrified at how ungrateful he has been. Notice the thinking that goes on, the imitating, the understanding that's involved. It's very, very complex and it's very moving at the same time. It's both feeling and thinking.
Well, and when you say moving, I've felt the last few minutes we're getting into Martin Buber territory here. It's like an I and thou.
I and thou.
Relationship.
The recognition
yes,
of another.
Yeah.
Right. Choosing to think about somebody else rather than yourself is something which is a first step to transcendence, actually, to turn away from yourself and look at another. Right?
Do you see a link between genuine gratitude and transcendence?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's actually a transcendent move because you are thinking, as I say, if you want something. What is natural is if somebody, I'm thirsty and somebody gives me water, I just drink. And the natural thing is to seize it and then walk off. The person who turns around to the person who gave to them and remembers that somebody gave that to them and thinks of that person is really making a huge step, which is not necessarily the case, right? So, there's a story in the Gospels. Do you remember where Jesus heals 10 lepers?
Yes.
And they all go off. They're all healed. They're all cured, all of them. But one of them comes back. And Jesus says, well, where are the other nine? And most people think, and I thought for a long time, that Jesus was hurt because they weren't grateful to him. But no, what's happening there is he's saying, you know, these people are all healed, but only one of them has been saved. Being grateful is being saved. The healing is not taken away, but this being saved is another story. And he would have liked them all to be saved.
So the gratitude is the big payoff moment of that story.
Absolutely. Being grateful means that he's saved.
Ingratitude can be as important a signal. You go to town on King Lear in your book.
Well, Shakespeare goes to town on King Lear too.
Yes, Shakespeare does indeed. But there's the beautiful, heartbreaking, chilling moment of ingratitude where, is it Goneril? It's one of the daughters and Lear says, I gave all to you. And one of the daughters said, and you took your sweet time about it too.
Yes, and in good time you gave it.
Shakespeare does it a bit more gracefully than I do, but
no, it's just chilling, absolutely chilling. What's fascinating? See, I think I said earlier that gratitude has a history. The idea of gratitude has a history.
Yes,
and there was a time in our own history when, for about 200 years, when ingratitude was considered the worst thing possible, the worst sin of all, worse than murder, worse than rape, worse than, for us it's really strange. I mean, we don't like, still don't like ingratitude, but we don't think
of it as the murder.
They weren't crazy about murder, but they thought that ingratitude was worse.
Wow.
And the reason, it's incredible for us. But then you realize that what they mean is that there is no every crime is a crime of ingratitude. Ingratitude is part of every sin there is. And every sin has ingratitude in it. And so the ungrateful person is capable of anything. Mm. That is the point of view of Shakespeare. And of course, ingratitude makes great stories. You know, vengeance is the opposite of gratitude, right? So vengeance is a great
That follow? How is vengeance the opposite of gratitude?
Well, vengeance is giving tit for tat, giving something back, right?
Yes.
It's equalizing, as you might consider giving something back to somebody is equalizing. And it is filled with thought, just like gratitude is, but it's hatred, right? Remember, vengeance is a dish best eaten cold.
Yes.
Remember? you sit there and think about this person you hate, which is it's the opposite. Opposites are always similar.
I'm fascinated by something you take on in the book, this idea of votive offerings. I'd like to hear more about what this kind of offering tells us about what it tells us about ourselves as human beings and the way we regard a divine power.
Mm. Well, I decided to do it because I'd been living in Spain, and you go into churches in Spain, and to this day you'll find little models of breasts and fingers and feet and things that hung up at shrines. And first sign, I mean, a lot of people just think it's horrible. They can't believe anybody would be so crude. But this is an extremely ancient. The reason why I went into it is because I wanted to show that it's not only a literary thing. It goes way before, this is prehistory. And for the last 3,000 years at least, people have been in the Mediterranean. People have been offering votive offerings. What they do is it's not a gift, strictly speaking, because what you do is you say to the divinity, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you, which is a shocking idea. I mean, you're not supposed to treat God like that. But people often do, and you get this in the Old Testament, you get it throughout Christianity, right up until the present, and it still exists.
Well, you call it a kind of bargaining
bargaining
the supernatural.
With God. If you do this for me, I'll do that. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It's really very primitive. But on the other hand, it's got a whole raison d'être about it, and I finally end up with the woman who said, you know, oh God, if my husband gets better, I will go on a pilgrimage, because it's often connected with pilgrimage.
Yes.
I will go on a pilgrimage and bring a votive offering and leave it at the shrine, and then her husband died. And we started the program about how the highest levels of religion, people are grateful for anything. This woman, this simple peasant woman, said, okay, my husband did not survive, but I'll take the offering anyway. And I think that you see how the highest and the simplest and the highest are connected, you know.
Mm.
And she was able to say to God, okay, I accept. And I love you still. You didn't give me what I wanted, but I will give you the gift anyway. You know, and this is really stratospheric, kind of attitude. As so often, the little ones understand.
You touch on the power, just the visceral, power of being in a church and seeing an array of little votive candles, and
yes.
I've felt this so often myself that it's almost hopes, dreams, fears, prayers come to life somehow. It's a physical offering of,
that's right.
I don't know, of something of the human being, of something of the soul. Maybe you can put this into words better than I, because I find it so moving.
Right.
And I don't know why.
See, these things embody people's deepest wishes, right? And in fact, one of the ways that votive offerings work is that they, when it's an offering that's given in response to an answered prayer, it shows everybody that my prayer has been answered. It's a way of thanking. Do you see? So, I mean, just the other day, actually, just a week ago, I was in Rome, and there's a statue of Saint Anthony. There's this magnificent church of Santa Maria in Trastevere, yes, one of the great buildings of the Western world, right? But at the back is this plaster statue of Saint Anthony. You know, he's not at all an art object at all. And he's absolutely drowned in letters. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters from people. And they keep taking them away, and the next day they're all back again. You know, the people have sent right letters to him thanking him for giving them something.
Well, and the authorities take them away.
The authorities take them away.
And then the next day, back and forth.
They start it up again. And I mean, people just do this individually. It's an individual thing, too. It's not a group service like the Mass, you know. It's an individual comes, and they make a recognition that they have received, and they're grateful.
And so personal.
And
it's such a personal thing.
Other people see that they have, they want to express in public. Much as in the Old Testament, a psalm was sung. You see, in the Old Testament, those psalms, where people have been, you know, the psalms do it so magnificently. They start with a person in real misery, you know. And at the end of the psalm, they say, but it's okay now. And then they break into this prayer. And then they invite people. What has happened is that they've invited their friends, and then they all together sing the psalm, which is in thanksgiving to God for what has happened. And so they sort of publicize the fact that something wonderful has been given to them. And that is a form of gratitude.
But is the offering compromised at all by this nature of bargaining with the divine? This, you know, on a grand scale, this quid pro quo. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, big guy.
Yeah, no, really. It shouldn't be, you know. It's not sort of, I don't know. I suppose, should I say it's not kosher? It's not supposed to be like that. But people... I think that God accepts it. God understands it. I mean, I don't feel judgmental about it. There are people who think it's sort of idolatry and turn it down and all this kind of thing, and it's understandable. But I think myself, it's very touching, and it shows an intimacy with God. I don't think I would do it. I don't think I would do it. But then I'm just one of these terrible sort of academics and things. You know, the other people are much closer to God. It's very hard to be close to God when you're an academic.
I always like to end interviews with a simple question about the future of civilization.
Good Lord. Yes.
So bear with me. No, this is your fault, Margaret, because you quote the German sociologist Georg Simmel saying, gratitude is no less than the moral memory of mankind. Do you think he was right?
Yes, I think he's totally right. It's really important. We have our own kind of take on gratitude, by the way, as we move into the ecological crises that are facing us. We're going to need really deep sources to enable us to change. To change our ways, and one of the things we can have, one of them can be gratitude. You know, if we are grateful enough for what we have, we will then look after it, appreciate it. So gratitude is a very profound thing, and we're in deep, deep need of it right now.
So you can see a paucity of gratitude having effects in more realms than etiquette.
Oh well, etiquette is merely the expression of what ought to be the case. The real case is feeling it. You know, you can pretend to be grateful. And also, now this is supposed to be the very end of the interview, but we haven't discussed the fact that the gratitude is not necessarily a good thing. You mustn't always be grateful for everything.
How so?
Well, because somebody might be manipulating you. You remember the song, you know, take back your Mink, take back your pearls. Did you? What made you think I was one of those girls? Yes. Yeah. there are times when you must say, no, I don't want this gift. I'm not grateful. I know this isn't really a gift. And in other words, the thinking.
I'm not one of those girls.
And you must, thinking has to be part of it. You've got to really be, you've got to make a judgment every time you feel grateful, because it's a matter of thinking as well as feeling.
Before I let you go, I'm fascinated by people's experiences of coming to a religious faith as an adult. You know, when you embrace a religion beyond the age of childhood with your parents making you go to church or go to synagogue or go to mosque. Yours happened at the gym, is that right?
That's right, yes. I had a... A lot of people don't meet God for the first time in church, you know.
Yeah, of course. God makes sense.
God's outside church. Yes, it did. It happened to me in a gym. A woman said to me, you know, we were doing these exercises and I was exhausted and, you know, your defenses are down, you know.
Yes, yeah.
So you're lying there and relaxing. And this woman said, turn over. Please, now turn over, she said. I remember her name. I've often tried to find her and I've never been able to find her. Perhaps I should go on Facebook or something. Anyway, she said, now turn over. And I turned over and there was this light over my head. And I'd had this mystical experience. I didn't expect it at all. I mean, she'd said, "Don't please turn over," hundreds of times before. I was going to these classes sort of three or four times a week for years, you know. But this time, who knows why? You know, I have no idea why this time and no other time. And it bang like that. And I just suddenly saw it all. I just suddenly had a flash and I saw everything. And I thought, you must be crazy. What are you doing with your life? You must be crazy. And I got up and because I wasn't religious at all at that time, right? And I sort of got up and left and I had to run across the campus to find a church, and I didn't even know where the church was. I ran past a church without realizing it was there, you know.
And maybe you should
totally out of it. That happens all in a moment. But then you have to live it, you know. That was 20 years ago. And well, nearly 20 years ago.
But maybe you should have been running around campus
more than
looking.
What am I saying? It's more than 20 years ago.
Yeah. Maybe you should have been looking for a gym.
Well, maybe I should go back to the gym. It's extraordinary because the body has a lot to do with the soul, you know. Grace breaks through, just breaks into you, and you somehow or other, and you have a right to say no. That's one of the things I experienced at that moment.
You can say no.
You can say no. You can say, I don't think this actually, I don't want to go that way. Or you can, I experienced that. I was given a choice. I was given a choice in a flash of a second. And I made my choice. You can turn it down. And this is essential. I mean, the gratitude is something which is to do with freedom, you know. It's a gift. I call it the gift of thanks. When somebody is grateful, they're giving something to somebody else, and it's done freely. Nobody can make you do it. Nobody can make you grateful. It's free.
Was part of your feeling at that moment gratitude? Was that a part of this whole piece?
Yes, it was. It was. I never thought of it, but I think it was. I'm trying to go over it again, you know. Yes, it was. Yes, it was great. It was gratitude.
I would love you to come back one day and tell me more. Margaret Visser, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me back.
A delight. Margaret Visser is the author of 6 books. Her latest is The Gift of Thanks, The Roots, Persistence, and Paradoxical Meanings of a Social Ritual. It's published by HarperCollins.
Lord, will you forgive me for forgetting? Well, to say thank you for the things that you do for me? Things are going so good. I get to feeling so fine. But if it wasn't for your giving, nothing, nothing would be mine. My Lord, will you forgive me? Well, to be grateful for the blessings that you bestowed on me. Things are getting so good, I get ahead of my time. But if it wasn't for your giving, nothing, nothing would be mine, my Lord. I wanna thank you for the air I breathe. Thank you for my hands and feet. Thank you for the love you give. Thank you, Lord, for letting me live. Thank you for another day. Thank you when you hear me pray. Thank you for heaven that you bestowed. Thank you, Lord, I'm grateful, Lord, forgive me. Yeah, for forgetting to be thankful. Yeah, bow on my knees every day in prayer. Things get so good, but if it wasn't for your giving, nothing, nothing would be mine. Oh yeah. If it wasn't for your giving, nothing, nothing would be mine. My Lord said if it wasn't for
Mavis Staples from her CD, Mavis Staples, Have a Little Faith. The song is I Wanna Thank You. I'm Mary Hines. This is Tapestry on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite 137. Every once in a while, we hear from David Wheel. David is a storyteller and writer in Prince Edward Island. He taught for 3 decades at the University of PEI. This is David Wheel reading his story, One Autumn.
One autumn, when I was 13 or 14, I was invited by an elderly couple who were friends of my parents to spend the weekend at their farm. I can't imagine what possessed me even to consider such a thing, but for some reason or other, I agreed. Now, these many years later, I have 3 distinct memories of the visit. The first is that there was nothing to do. The second is that I had a marvelous time. And the third is that the visit was marred by circumstances that anticipated one of the defining struggles of my life. I was dropped off on Friday afternoon with the promise I would be picked up on Sunday, and although it was only a couple of days, it seemed a long time to be alone with 2 ancient adults. I was most apprehensive. But as it turned out, I wasn't there very long before an unanticipated change occurred in me, and I know it had something to do with how quiet it was, and how alone I was most of the time. Roaming through back fields, poking around in old buildings, or stretched out in the sun in their enclosed front veranda with a large stack of old Reader's Digests. I wouldn't say I had a lot of fun, but what was extraordinary was that as the hours drifted by, I became more and more content with my situation, and eventually settled into a deep inner stillness. Words like serenity and tranquility weren't even in my vocabulary. But that's what I experienced, a lovely serenity that lasted most of the duration of my visit. Some of the most rich and transparent moments in my life have been during periods when I was not wanting anything or waiting for anything. Those times have been few and far between, but that weekend on the farm was one of them. I also felt very alert. In the midst of the quietness, I experienced an enhanced awareness that enabled me to perceive things directly. It's not an easy thing to explain, but I felt a kind of magnification of perception. Everything appeared more present than usual. The old couple, Mel and Alice, left me alone. But I wasn't lonesome. In fact, it was just the opposite. During much of the time I was there, I felt intimately connected to everything around me. The little farm was superficially very ordinary, but what I discovered there was an extravagant and ravishing loveliness. The air was fresh and clear and bright with that special quality of light that returns to Prince Edward Island every year following the blur of summer humidity, making everything appear wonderfully vivid and accessible. I especially remember the toadstools. It seemed everywhere I looked there was one different from the others. Some were tiny and thin, like matches with red caps, while others were wide and flat, like dinner plates, and still others pitted and irregular, like the clinkers that came out of our coal furnace. They were lime and pink and orange and yellow with white spots, and they were all magical, like props from another smaller world. There were shiny rose hips and clumps of blue asters, yellow hanging apples, and purple protruding turnips. The mahogany luster of fallen chestnuts and low-hanging clusters of red dogberries. It was autumn, and I was harvesting images and beauty. But that's not the whole story. The one discordant part of my visit occurred on Sunday. My parents, you see, were very strict about church attendance, and because there was no congregation of our denomination in the community, they had instructed I should listen on Sunday afternoon to a certain radio program sponsored by our church. If I remember correctly, it was called Where the Bible Speaks. When I told Mel and Alice about this, they informed me the battery in their radio was dead, but said I could go to one of the neighbors and listen there. Damn. It was a dreadful quandary. I didn't want to disappoint my parents, but as a shy, introverted adolescent, it was torture for me to have to invite myself into the kitchen of strangers and to sit in silent agony for half an hour, all the while wanting desperately to flee. My peaceful, easy feeling was destroyed, replaced by consternation. It was terribly ironic. There I was, surrounded by autumn glory, suffused with a deep, unself-conscious reverence I had never experienced in church, yet feeling constrained to leave all that and go to someone's house and listen to a strident minister who preached from the Bible the way others brandish a club. Mel accompanied me across the field to the neighbor's place and graciously sat with me as I stared at the floor, faking interest. Finally, the ordeal ended, and on my way home, I was relieved and pleased that my parents would be happy with me. Discord had been averted. However, in the name of religion, I had behaved in a manner that had nothing whatever to do with my own spirit, and that, over time, would become the biggest discord of all. What seemed avoided was merely postponed, and autumn turned to winter.
David Wheel reading from his collection of essays, Chasing the Shore, Little Stories About Spirit and Landscape. It's published by Tangle Lane. Maybe you've had the feeling at a concert, at a game, at a bar, a moment of pure joy. Collective joy, a celebration shared. The writer Barbara Ehrenreich says, if you have enjoyed a piece of collective joy, lucky you, because moments like this are a lot less common than they once were. Ehrenreich has written a book called Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. She argues that we are desperately missing times like this, that they are essential for our spiritual health and for our development as a society. We're going to hear from Barbara Ehrenreich in the weeks ahead on Tapestry. First, we would like to hear from you. Have you ever felt a moment of pure collective joy? Maybe at a rock concert, a sports stadium, in a church, as part of a choir, at a street festival, at a dance? Write us a note and tell us all about it. What happened and what did it mean to you? What did it do to you? But please, don't tell the story of singing Breakdown along with 20,000 of your new best friends at the Tom Petty concert. I'm going to tell that one. Tell us about your experience of collective joy. Drop us a line at tapestry@cbc.ca. And that's it for this week. Thank you for listening. Tapestry is produced by Susan Mahoney and Aaron Pettit. Sound production is by Dave Field and Tim Lorimer. Our webmaster is Liz Nagy. All of our programs are posted online at our website, cbc.ca/tapestry. That's also where you can find out what's coming up on the show and download our weekly podcast. I'm Mary Hines. See you next week.
When what you're listening to gets to be a bit too much, it's good to go back to where it all began, the radio. Tune in to WHFR.FM for relaxing live shows, hosts you can connect with, and alternative variety music that you won't be able to get enough of. That's WHFR.FM at 89.3. WHFR Dearborn. We're making waves, so dial in and catch them.
Welcome to WHFR. My name is The Diva, and my show is on Saturdays from 5 to 8 p.m. It's called Lyrical Infusion with The Diva. But I'm nothing without you. Why don't you make a date with the diva and come let me play just for you. Saturdays, 5 to 8 p.m., Lyrical Infusion with the Diva and you. 89.3 WHFR.FM.
And of course, you are listening to WHFR Dearborn. Thanks for having us on in the background for your Thanksgiving. We'll have more coming up. WHFR Dearborn.
To protect his family from disaster, Steve used his camera phone.
Done.
By taking pictures of his important documents, Steve can always have them stored online. Learn more simple disaster prep tips at ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.